To complete the series of windows to the past, this one will bring you selected sacred writings on each of the Baha'i holy days, as well as related stories. By no means is this window meant to replace direct referral to the Baha'i writings in preparing to commemorate a holy day. However, it might prove useful to those believers who have limited access to books. Also, having in mind the new believers and seekers, it is prepared in simple language. To avoid interruption for turning the tape, the holy days will be presented in the following order: Introduction, Rizwan, and Birth of Baha'u'llah, Tape 1, Side A. Declaration of the Bab, Birth of Abdu'l-Bahá, and Birth of the Bab, Tape 1, Side B. Nowruz, the Day of the Covenant, and Ascension of Abdu'l-Bahá, Tape 2, Side A. Martyrdom of the Bab, and Ascension of Baha'u'llah, Tape 2, Side B. The holy days on which work and school should be suspended are the birth and ascension of Baha'u'llah, the first, ninth, and 12th days of Rizwan, the birth, declaration, and martyrdom of the Bab, and Nowruz. According to Shoghi Effendi, the Guardian, the anniversaries of the birth and the ascension of Abdu'l-Bahá are not to be regarded as days on which work is prohibited. The celebration of these two days is, however, obligatory. For your information, we share the following quotations from Shoghi Effendi, which are printed on the back of the wall calendar produced by the United States Baha'i Publishing Trust. The Baha'i day starts and ends at sunset, and consequently the date of the celebrations of Baha'i feast should be adjusted to conform to the Baha'i calendar time. The Guardian would advise that, if feasible, the friends should commemorate certain of the feasts and anniversaries at the following time: the anniversary of the declaration of the Bab on May 22nd, at about 2 hours after sunset; the first day of Rizwan at about 3 p.m. on the 21st of April; the anniversary of the martyrdom of the Bab on July 9 at about noon; the anniversary of the ascension of Baha'u'llah on May 29th at 3 a.m. the ascension of Abdu'l-Bahá on November 28th at 1 a.m. On other anniversaries, the believers are free to gather at any time during the day which they find convenient. Regarding your question of the proper time to celebrate or hold our meetings of commemoration, the time should be fixed by counting after sunset. The Master passed away 1 hour after midnight, which falls a certain number of hours after sunset. So his passing should be commemorated according to the sun and regardless of daylight saving time. The same applies to the ascension of Baha'u'llah, who passed away about 8 hours after sunset.
Regarding suspension of work on the 9 holy days, a few categories need to be addressed. These are independent businesses, physicians, school children, and administrative meetings. In a letter, the Guardian wrote to the National Spiritual Assembly of the United States the following, quote, "Believers who have independent businesses or shops should refrain from working on these days. Those who are in government employ should, on religious grounds, make an effort to be excused from work. All believers, whoever their employers, should do likewise. If the government or their employers refuse to grant them these days off, they are not required to forfeit their employment," end quote. For doctors, Shoghi Effendi states that, quote, "It is better for Baha'i doctors not to work on our 9 holy days. But, of course, that does not mean they should not attend to very sick people and emergencies on these days," end quote. In another letter from The Guardian, he stated, quote, "Regarding children, at 15, a Baha'i is of age as far as keeping the laws of the Akdas is concerned, prayer, fasting, etc. But children under 15 should certainly observe the Baha'i holy days and not go to school if that can be arranged on these 9 days," end quote. In a letter from the Universal House of Justice, it is stated, quote, "Concerning the suspension of Baha'i administrative activities on Baha'i holy days, we have found the texts of the Guardian's instructions in which he says that the work of local assemblies, committees, and other institutions of the faith, preferably, should be suspended, but that the final decision rests with the Universal House of Justice. We feel that the time is not yet ripe to add anything further, and therefore we leave the application of the above instructions of the Guardian to your National Assembly," end quote. As for observing holidays of other religions, such as Christmas, Shoghi Effendi states, quote, "As regards the celebration of the Christian holidays by the believers, it is surely preferable and highly advisable that the friends should, in their relation to each other, discontinue observing such holidays as Christmas and New Year, and to have the festival gatherings of this nature, instead, during intercalary days and Nowruz," end quote. The celebration of the festive anniversaries is different from the observances of the ascensions and martyrdom. Good discretion in arrangements for these occasions is essential. For instance, an event where children and adults engage in noisy games or sports is not conducive to an atmosphere of reverence on the martyrdom of the Bab. On reciting the tablet or prayer of visitation, one may stand or sit. When standing, one may face any direction. What may be practiced in this regard in certain localities or country should not become a tradition elsewhere. For your convenience, the timing of each presentation is mentioned at the beginning. However, in the 3 presentations, which are for the Ascension of Baha'u'llah, Martyrdom of the Bab, and the Ascension of Abdu'l-Baha, the time given for each presentation does not include the tablet of visitation. The purpose of this is to enable you to begin the tablet at the designated time. Festival of Rezvan, presentation, 22 minutes.
What better word for opening the celebration of the King of Festivals than this utterance of Baha'u'llah?
Quote, "Verily I say, this is the day in which mankind can behold the face and hear the voice of the Promised One. The call of God hath been raised. and the light of his countenance hath been lifted upon men. It behooveth every man to blot out the trace of every idle word from the tablet of his heart, and gaze with an open and unbiased mind on the signs of his revelation, the proofs of his mission, and the tokens of his glory." End quote. In the Ketuvot Akdas, he states this about the festival of Rezvan. Quote, "Say, the most great festival is indeed the king of festivals. Call ye to mind, O people, the bounty which God hath conferred upon you. Ye were sunk in slumber, and then, lo, he aroused you by the reviving breezes of his revelation, and made known unto you his manifest and undeviating path." End quote.
A few words on the history preceding that epoch-making event and mention of a few facts helps us to better appreciate the significance of Rezvan of 1863. The first luminary heralding the advent of the Bab, namely Sheikh Ahmad-e Ahsaoui, made this precise promise about Baha'u'llah. As you may know, Sheikh Ahmad died in 1826 when the Bab was 7 years old. He wrote, "The mystery of this cause must needs be manifest, and the secret of this message must needs be divulged. I can say no more. I can appoint no time. His cause will be made known after hin." In Abjad letters, hin equals 68 and 1268 in Islamic calendar coincide with the year 1852. The closing verse of that passage is quite alarming. As he said, "Ask me not of things which if revealed unto you might only pain you." You see, that visionary man could see the black pit in Tehran where Baha'u'llah was imprisoned and where he received his mission. Although the Bab had made several references to the years 9 and 19 for the appearance of Baha'u'llah, nevertheless, he makes it abundantly clear that the time of the advent of Baha'u'llah is entirely in his own hands. The years 9 and 19 synchronize with 1852 and 1863. The place for such momentous event was foretold by Baha'u'llah. The story of Sheikh Hassan al-Zanuzi will illustrate this. During the incarceration of the Bab in the prison fortress of Chehrir, when the struggle of a band of his followers hemmed in at Fort Sheikh Tabarsi was at its peak, he told this to Sheikh Hassan: "Had it not been for my confinement in this prison, I would be going and lending my assistance to Quddus." Quddus was the last letter of the living and the leader in that fort. Then he told Sheikh Hassan, "However, this obligation does not apply to you. You proceed to Karbala and stay there, for you shall behold with your own eyes the countenance of Baha'u'llah." He obeyed his lord, and after the passing of a year or so, he heard the news of the martyrdom of the Bab in Tabriz. It was in October of 1851 when, for the first time, he saw the radiant face of Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah, then known as Janab-e Baha, approached the Sheikh and walked in the marketplace as he held Sheikh Hassan's hand. He told the Sheikh, "Praise be to God that you have remained in Karbala and are beholding the beauty of the Promised One." The awestruck Sheikh remembered the promise of the Bab and wished at once to shout his discovery. Baha'u'llah told him to conceal it and contain his excitement. Then Baha'u'llah said, "Not yet. The appointed hour is approaching." On that occasion, Baha'u'llah told him that such a declaration would take place in Baghdad. Friends, This forecast was not made while Baha'u'llah was on his way to Baghdad, or even a few years earlier, but it was 12 years before his declaration in the Rizwan Garden of Baghdad, and about 10 months before his imprisonment in the Siyahchal in Tehran. And now, these words of Baha'u'llah about the festival of Rizwan, which Sheikh Ahmad and Sheikh Hassan yearned to see.
Quote, "This is the day whereon the unseen world crieth out, Great is thy blessedness, O earth, for thou hast been made the footstool of thy God, and been chosen as the seat of his mighty throne. The realm of glory exclaimeth, Would that my life could be sacrificed for thee, for he who is the beloved of the All-Merciful hath established his sovereignty upon thee, through the power of his name that has been promised unto all things, whether of the past or of the future." End quote.
A review of the highlights of the last year of Baha'u'llah's stay in Baghdad, leading up to his declaration, prepares us for that occasion. The British Consul General in Baghdad offered Baha'u'llah the protection of British citizenship and his safe transfer to India or anywhere. Baha'u'llah declined that offer. The friendly governor of Baghdad, Namiq Pasha, received the first of five successive commands from the Grand Vizier of Turkey to transfer Baha'u'llah to Constantinople, now called Istanbul. In the next 3 months, four more orders were received and similarly ignored before the governor was compelled to comply. Meanwhile, with approach of Nowruz, the followers were busy preparing the garden of Bashash and raised the needed tents. This delightful spot was not too far from Baha'u'llah's house and was close to the river. Again, everyone anticipated another 2 weeks in the presence of their beloved celebrating Nowruz. In the Persian custom, Nowruz is celebrated for 12 days. And the 13th should be spent in the country. It was in the afternoon of the fifth day of Nowruz when Baha'u'llah revealed the tablet of the Holy Mariner, forecasting the ominous events. Immediately after his scribe chanted the tablet, Baha'u'llah ordered that all tents should be folded for the last time and everyone return to the city. The companions had not left yet when a messenger from the governor arrived, summoning Baha'u'llah. The next day, the deputy governor handed over the order from the central government to Baha'u'llah. The governor could not bring himself to be the one to break the sad news. On learning of his imminent departure, large numbers of admirers and followers crowded his house, which could not accommodate the visitors, and the Holy Family had to begin preparing for the journey. A notable of Baghdad, Najib Pasha, immediately put his garden park, called Najibiyye, at Baha'u'llah's disposal. In that year, Nowruz fell on the 22nd of March. 31 days after Nowruz, the 22nd of April 1863, Baha'u'llah wore a taj as a symbol of his station and left his house for the last time. When Baha'u'llah appeared in the courtyard of his house, his grief-stricken companions prostrated at his feet. For some time he stood there, speaking words of comfort to the weeping crowd. Baha'u'llah in a tablet mentions that when he had walked toward the gate of his house, a child of only a few years ran forward and, clinging to his robe, wept aloud, begging him in his tender young voice not to leave. The lamentation of the admirers outside his house was not less than that of his followers. As he walked toward the banks of the river Tigris, among the disconsolate and grief-stricken crowd, a Persian lady of noble birth, who was not a believer, pushed her way into the crowd and, with gesture of sacrifice, laid her child at the feet of Baha'u'llah. At length he reached the banks of the river and was ferried across, accompanied by his sons and the scribe. Of course, some followers had gone in advance to prepare that heavenly spot. The muazzin had just raised the afternoon call for prayer when Baha'u'llah entered the Najibiyya garden, later called by his followers the Garden of Rizwan, or Paradise. Although previous to his declaration he had not disclosed his station, some Babis far and near were convinced that he was the promised one by the Bab, but the majority had no idea. The pen of Baha'u'llah wrote of that spring day,
"The divine springtime is come, O most exalted pen, for the festival of the All-Merciful is fast approaching. Bestir thyself and magnify before the entire creation the name of God, and celebrate his praise. Speak, and hold not thy peace. The day star of blissfulness shineth above the horizon of our name, the blissful, inasmuch as the kingdom of the name of God hath been adorned with the ornament of the name of thy Lord, the Creator of the heavens. Arise before the nations of the earth, and arm thyself with the power of this most great name, and be not of those who tarry."
Baha'u'llah spent 12 days in that garden. According to Abdu'l-Bahá, on the first day he declared his mission to the companions who were present and announced with great joy the inauguration of the festival of Rizwan. Through his historic, awe-inspiring declaration, he changed all sorrow into joy. In one of his tablets, he has referred to the first day of Rizwan as the day of supreme felicity, and has called on his followers to rejoice with exceeding gladness in remembrance of that day. The exact circumstances and Baha'u'llah's exact words are shrouded in obscurity. The fragmentary description left for posterity is by the historian Nabil. He writes, "Every day at the hour of dawn, the gardeners would pick the roses which lined the four avenues of the garden, and would pile them in the center of the floor of his blessed tent. So great would be the heap, that when his companions gathered to drink their morning tea in his presence, they would be unable to see each other across it. All these roses Baha'u'llah would, with his own hands, entrust to those whom he dismissed from his presence every morning to be delivered on his behalf to his Arab and Persian friends in the city. A constant stream of people from all walks of life flowed to that garden each day. As for the believers, Baha'u'llah would summon a number of them to come each day and would dismiss them in the evening. Only those without family ties were allowed to remain for the night. Some of them would keep vigil around his tent." Although the words of his declaration are not known, there is a tablet from Baha'u'llah which throws light on some of his utterances on that day. According to that tablet, on the first day of Rizwan, Baha'u'llah made three important statements to his followers. The first was to forbid the use of sword when attacked or persecuted on account of their faith. The second statement was that no manifestation of God would appear before the expiration of 1,000 years. The Kitab-e-Aqdas specifies that October 1852, when he received his mission in the Sea of Chao, marks the commencement of the 1,000 years or more. The third was that the moment he uttered those words, all the names and attributes of God were fully manifested within all created things. By this, he implied the advent of a new day and the infusion of a fresh capacity into all beings. Of the notables and the government officials who came to see him, one was Naumich Paoshao, the governor. He apologized for what had occurred and insisted on being of some service. Baha'u'llah told him to be considerate and fair to the followers, to which he gave his promise. The governor also wrote a letter addressed to the officials on the way to provide for the travelers and handed it to the officer who accompanied Baha'u'llah. However, Baha'u'llah did not permit acceptance of such offers and bought all of the provisions needed in those 4 months on the road from Baghdad to Istanbul. Referring to his declaration, Baha'u'llah states,
"Arise and proclaim unto the entire creation the tidings that He who is the All-Merciful hath directed His steps towards the Rizwan and entered it. Guide then the people unto the Garden of Delight which God hath made the throne of His paradise. We have chosen thee to be our most mighty trumpet, whose blast is to signalize the resurrection of all mankind."
Of those memorable days, Nabil states, "One night, the ninth night of the waxing moon, I happened to be one of those who watched beside His blessed tent. As the hour of midnight approached, I saw Him issue from His tent, pass by the places where some of His companions were sleeping, and begin to pace up and down the moonlit, flower-bordered avenues of the garden. So loud was the singing of the nightingales on every side that only those who were near him could distinctly hear his voice. He continued to walk until, pausing in the midst of one of these avenues, he observed, 'Consider these nightingales. So great is their love for these roses that sleepless from dusk to dawn, they warble their melodies and commune with burning passion with the object of their adoration. How then can those who claim to be a fire with the rose-like beauty of the beloved choose to sleep? For 3 successive nights I watched and circled around his blessed tent. Every time I passed by the couch whereon he lay, I would find him wakeful. And every day from morn to eventide, I would see him ceaselessly engaged in conversing with the stream of visitors who kept flowing in from Baghdad. Not once I could discover in the words he spoke any trace of dissimulation." On the ninth day of Rizwan, the family of Baha'u'llah moved to the Najibiyeh garden, and the 12th day was appointed for departure. Of the 12 days that Baha'u'llah spent in the Garden of Rizwan, 3 are regarded as holy days: the first day, the ninth day, and the 12th day. According to Shoghi Effendi, the ninth day is on account of the holiness of the number 9. At last, the mules were loaded and hodas were mounted on them for the ladies and children. Then, as sunset was approaching, everyone took their places, and a beautiful red-roaned stallion called Saudi, the finest horse his followers could afford, was brought out for Baha'u'llah. At this time, Baha'u'llah wore a taj, a finely embroidered felt headdress. In Persian, the meaning of taj is crown. During his years in Baghdad, though horses were available, he chose to ride a donkey. But on the last day of Rizwan, he visibly wielded the symbolic signs of divine authority by wearing a torch and riding a horse. Seeing Baha'u'llah in the saddle and ready to depart, evoked from the vast crowd heart-rending cries of agony. People threw themselves in the path of his horse, and as a believer has related, it seemed as if that heavenly steed was passing over sanctified bodies. The tearful eyes of his followers and admirers watched him disappear into the setting sun. We will close the celebration of the anniversary of Rizwan with this utterance of Baha'u'llah.
Verily, all created things were immersed in the sea of purification when, on that first day of Rizwan, we shed upon the whole of creation the splendors of our most excellent names and our most exalted attributes. This, verily, is a token of my loving providence, which hath encompassed all the world. Birth of Baha'u'llah, presentation, 11 minutes.
In the Kitab-e-Aqdas, Baha'u'llah addresses Tehran with these words.
Rejoice with great joy, for God hath made thee the dayspring of his light, inasmuch as within thee was born the manifestation of his glory. Be thou glad for this name that hath been conferred upon thee, a name through which the day-star of grace hath shed its splendor, through which both earth and heaven have been illumined.
On that dawn of November 12, 1817, when ordinary people were fast asleep, a visionary holy man was awake, realizing who was born at that very hour. His name was Haji Hassan from Na'in. His disciple, who has related these stories to Nabil the historian, states, I heard him one day, after he had offered his morning prayer, speak words as these. Ere long will the earth be turned to paradise. Ere long will Persia be made the shrine round which will circle the peoples of the earth. On the morning of November 12, 1817, at the hour of dawn, the disciple found Haji Hassan fallen upon his face, repeating in rapt devotion the words, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, meaning God is most great. He states, to my great surprise, he turned to me and said, That which I have been announcing to you is now revealed. At this very hour, the light of the Promised One has broken and is shedding illumination upon the world. The words which that holy man spoke to him kept ringing in his ears until he heard of the advent of the Bab. But when he inquired from his followers about the date of his birth, it did not correspond with November 12, 1817. Matter of fact, it was 2 years later. However, when Baha'u'llah was in Baghdad, he learned that the hour and the date of his birth was exactly when Haji Hassan had recognized and announced it to him. The disciple of Haji Hassan told Nabil, I fell prostrate on the ground and exclaimed, Glorified art thou, my God, for having enabled me to attain unto this promised day. If now I be called to thee, I die content and assured. That very year he passed away. Mirza Hussein Ali, who in 1863 assumed the name Baha'ullah, was born and raised in Tehran. His genealogy goes to Yazdegerd III, the last king of Sasanian dynasty, and to Zoroaster, prophet of Persia in ancient times. Baha'ullah's father, Mirza Abbas from the district of Nur, was a man of nobility and had a position in the royal court. His title, given by the king, was Mirza Buzurge Vazir. Vazir is a title for anyone holding a position in the court. Baha'ullah's mother, Khadija Khanum, had been married before and had three children. When she was widowed, Mirza Buzurg married her. Baha'ullah was the third child from that union. The infancy of Baha'ullah was a cause of astonishment to his mother, as he never cried. When only 5 or 6 years old, he dreamt that he was in a garden where huge birds were flying overhead and attacking him, but they could not harm him. Then he went to bathe in the sea, and there he was attacked by fishes, but they too could cause him no injury. Baha'ullah related this strange dream to his father, who sent for a man who interpreted dreams. After the ritual of calculations, he told Baha'ullah's father that the expanse of the sea was this world in its entirety, and the birds and fishes were the peoples of the world assailing his son, because he would promulgate something of vital importance related to the minds of men. But they would be powerless to harm him. He would triumph over them all.
It is related that one day, when Baha'u'llah was 7 years old, as he was walking, his parents were watching him, and his mother remarked that he was a little short in stature. His father replied, "That matters not. Do you not know how intelligent he is and what a wonderful mind he has?" When Baha'u'llah was a child, his father saw an unusual dream, which was somewhat alarming. He dreamt that Baha'u'llah appeared to be swimming in a vast, limitless ocean. Around his head, which could distinctly be seen above the waters, there radiated in all directions his long jet-black locks, flowing in great profusion above the waves. In that dream he saw that a multitude of fishes gathered around him, each one holding fast to the end of one hair. They followed him in whatsoever direction he swam, holding tight to each hair, but could not detach a single hair from his head. Greatly impressed by this dream, the father summoned a dream interpreter who gave a similar interpretation as the one before. Later on, that interpreter was taken to look at Baha'u'llah. Among his comments, one particularly stands out. He said, "Every expression in that face revealed to his eyes a sign of his concealed glory." From that day on, his father became more passionately devoted to him. The education which Baha'u'llah received was limited both in nature and extent. As he himself states in the tablet to the king of Persia, "The learning current amongst men I studied not, their schools I entered not. Ask of the city where I dwelt, that thou mayest be well assured that I am not of them who speak falsely."
In those days, the sons of noble houses were taught in matters such as horsemanship, handling a gun, wielding a sword, calligraphy, classical literature, and knowledge of the holy book, the Quran. By the time Baha'u'llah was 14, his rare understanding, his complete mastery of reason and logic, his unparalleled power of exposition were remarked upon in all circles. However, he never was assertive or argumentative, rather always courteous and patient. Only one thing offended him greatly, and that was when anyone made a disrespectful reference to the messengers of God. Even then, he would admonish the offender with kindliness and calm. In a tablet, Baha'u'llah tells of an incident in his childhood when two hugely turbaned divines were expounding on some theological questions. One such question was whether the angel Gabriel had a higher station than the slave of Imam Ali. Baha'u'llah writes that his response to that question was that Gabriel was the one through whom the Holy Spirit descended upon Muhammad. Then even the master of that slave, namely Imam Ali, had no entry to that station. There are many stories revealing his innate knowledge. You may wonder if the young Baha'u'llah knew who he was before he received his mission in the Siyahchal at the age of 35. Baha'u'llah in a tablet states that as a child a transformation occurred and the ocean of utterance began to surge within him and never stopped. Abdul Baha states that a prophet of God is born a prophet but is like a lamp under a bushel. When he received his mission, that is a time when the covering is removed and the light shines forth. Or, he is like a sleeping man in whom all faculties and powers are latent until he wakes up. Let us now celebrate the anniversary of the birth of the Prince of Peace, Baha'u'llah, and be grateful that we live in this day of days which Baha'u'llah proclaims.
This is the day whereon naught can be seen except the splendors of the light that shineth from the face of thy Lord, the gracious, the most bountiful. The birth of Baha'u'llah is the fulfillment of Isaiah's vision in every regard. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it, and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this.
Thank you.
Declaration of the Bab and Birth of Abdu'l-Bahá. Presentation, 28 minutes.
May 23, 1844, when the Bab's declaration took place, as well as the day of Abdu'l-Bahá's birth, was celebrated exclusively during the lifetime of Abdu'l-Bahá as the anniversary of the inauguration of the Bab's dispensation. However, after Abdu'l-Bahá's passing, his appointed successor, Shoghi Effendi, wrote, quote, "The anniversaries of the birth and the ascension of Abdu'l-Bahá are not to be regarded as days on which work is prohibited. The celebration of these 2 days is, however, obligatory." End quote. In the presentation for today, both joyous occasions will be addressed. The Bab proclaims,
"I am the mystic fane which the hand of omnipotence hath reared. I am the lamp which the finger of God hath lit within its niche, and caused to shine with deathless splendor. I am the flame of that supernal light that glowed upon Sinai. And from the prison fortress of Maku, he wrote this to the king, I am the primal point from which have been generated all created things."
The Guardian, referring to the station of the Bab, asserts, quote, "that he is not to be regarded merely as an inspired precursor of Baha'u'llah's revelation, that in his person, as he himself bears witness in the Persian Bayan, the object of all the prophets gone before him have been fulfilled, is a truth which I feel it my duty to demonstrate and emphasize." End quote. Then the Guardian states, "Indeed, the chief motive actuating me to undertake the task of editing and translating Nabil's immortal narrative has been to enable every follower of the faith in the West to better understand and more readily grasp the tremendous implications of his exalted station and more ardently admire and love him." The appearance of 2 manifestations of God within such a short interval of 9 years is addressed in the following utterance of Baha'u'llah, quote, "that so brief a span should have separated this most mighty and wondrous revelation from mine own previous manifestation is a secret that no man can unravel and a mystery such as no mind can fathom." End quote. With this introduction, the significance of the celebration of the anniversary of the declaration of the Bab is better understood and appreciated. On that 22nd day of May, 1844, the prophetic cycle ended and the cycle of fulfillment was ushered in by the declaration of the Bab. The anniversary of that unique and wondrous day will be celebrated for 5,000 centuries, the duration of this cycle. On that day, the Bab, whose given name was Ali Muhammad, a merchant from Shiraz, a city in southern Iran, declared his cause to Mullah Hussein, a 32-year-old theological student. The Bab's age was 25. Mullah Hussein, like most of the followers of their last teacher, was searching for the promised Qa'im and, through a magnetic force, was drawn towards Shiraz. Let Nabil, the great historian, tell you the story told to him firsthand. On that very day, a few hours before sunset, whilst Mullah Hussein walking outside the gate of the city, his eyes fell suddenly upon a youth of radiant countenance who wore a green turban and who, advancing towards him, greeted him with a smile of loving welcome. He embraced Mullah Hussein with tender affection, as though he had been his intimate and lifelong friend. Mullah Hussein taught him at first to be a disciple of Sayyid Kazem, who, on being informed of his approach to Shiraz, had come to welcome him. Mirza Ahmad Ghazvini, the martyr, is quoted, "I have heard Mullah Hussein repeatedly and graphically describe the circumstances of that remarkable interview with these words. The youth who met me outside the gate of Shiraz overwhelmed me with expressions of affection and loving kindness. He extended to me a warm invitation to visit his home and there refresh myself after the fatigue of my journey. I prayed to be excused, pleading that my two companions had already arranged for my stay in that city and were now awaiting my return. Commit them to the care of God," was his reply. "He will surely protect and watch over them." Having spoken these words, he bade me follow him. I was profoundly impressed by the gentle yet compelling manner in which that youth spoke to me. As I followed him, his gait, the charm of his voice, the dignity of his bearing served to enhance my first impressions of this unexpected meeting. We soon found ourselves standing at the gate of a house of modest appearance. He knocked at the door, which was soon opened by an Ethiopian servant. "Enter therein in peace, secure," were his words as he crossed the threshold and motioned me to follow him. His invitation, uttered with power and majesty, penetrated my soul. I thought it a good omen to be addressed in such words, standing as I did on the threshold of the first house I was entering in Shiraz, a city the very atmosphere of which had produced already an indescribable impression upon me. Might not my visit to this house, I thought to myself, enable me to draw nearer to the object of my quest? Might it not hasten the termination of a period of intense longing, strenuous search, of increasing anxiety which such a quest involved? As I entered the house and followed my host to his chamber, a feeling of unutterable joy invaded my being. Immediately we were seated. He ordered a ewer of water to be brought and bade me wash away from my hands and feet the stains of travel. I pleaded permission to retire from his presence and perform my ablutions in an adjoining room. He refused to grant my request and proceeded to pour the water over my hands. He then gave me to drink of a refreshing beverage, after which he asked for the samovar and himself prepared the tea, which he offered me. Overwhelmed with his acts of extreme kindness, I arose to depart. "The time for evening prayer is approaching," I ventured to observe. "I have promised my friends to join them at that hour in the Masjid-e-Ilkhani." With extreme courtesy and calm, he replied, "You must surely have made the hour of your return conditional upon the will and pleasure of God. It seems that His will has decreed otherwise. You need have no fear of having broken your pledge." His dignity and self-assurance silenced me. I renewed my ablutions and prepared for prayer. He too stood beside me and prayed. Whilst praying, I unburdened my soul, which was much oppressed, both by the mystery of this interview and the strain and stress of my search. I breathed this prayer: "I have striven with all my soul, O my God, and until now have failed to find thy promised messenger. I testify that thy word faileth not, and thy promise is sure." That night, that memorable night, was the eve preceding the fifth day of Jamaadul Awwal in the year 1260 AH, corresponding to the evening of May 22, 1844 AD.
It was about an hour after sunset when my youthful host began to converse with me. "Whom, after Sayyid Kazem," he asked me, "do you regard as his successor and your leader?" "At the hour of his death," I replied, "our departed teacher insistently exhorted us to forsake our homes, to scatter far and wide, in quest of the promised beloved. I have accordingly journeyed to Persia, have arisen to accomplish his will, and am still engaged in my quest." "Has your teacher," he further inquired, "given any detailed indications as to the distinguishing features of the promised one?" "Yes," I replied, "he is of pure lineage, is of illustrious descent, and of the seed of Fatime. As to his age, he is more than 20 and less than 30. He is endowed with innate knowledge. He is of medium height, abstains from smoking, and is free from bodily deficiency." He paused for a while and then with vibrant voice declared, "Behold, all these signs are manifest in me." He then considered each of the above-mentioned signs separately and conclusively demonstrated that each and all were applicable to his person. I was greatly surprised and politely observed, "He whose advent we await is a man of unsurpassed holiness, and the cause he is to reveal, a cause of tremendous power. Many and diverse are the requirements which he who claims to be its visible embodiment must needs fulfill. How often has Sayyid Kazem referred to the vastness of the knowledge of the Promised One? How often did he say, 'My own knowledge is but a drop compared with that with which he has been endowed. All my attainments are but a speck of dust in the face of the immensity of his knowledge. Nay, immeasurable is the difference.'" No sooner had those words dropped from my lips than I found myself seized with fear and remorse, such as I could neither conceal nor explain. I bitterly reproved myself and resolved at that very moment to alter my attitude and to soften my tone. I vowed to God that should my host again refer to the subject, I would, with the utmost humility, answer and say, "If you be willing to substantiate your claim, you will most assuredly deliver me from the anxiety and suspense which so heavily oppress my soul. I shall truly be indebted to you for such deliverance." When I first started upon my quest, I determined to regard the two following standards as those whereby I could ascertain the truth of whosoever might claim to be the promised Ghaim. The first was a treatise which I had myself composed, bearing upon the abstruse and hidden teachings propounded by Sheikh Ahmad and Sayyid Kazem. Whoever seemed to me capable of unraveling the mysterious allusions made in that treatise, to him I would next submit my second request, and would ask him to reveal, without the least hesitation or reflection, a commentary on the Surah of Joseph, in a style and language entirely different from the prevailing standards of the time. I had previously requested Sayyid Kazem, in private, to write a commentary on that same Surah, which he refused, saying, "This is verily beyond me. He, that great one, who comes after me, will, unasked, reveal it for you. That commentary will constitute one of the weightiest testimonies of his truth, and one of the clearest evidences of the loftiness of his position." I was revolving these things in my mind when my distinguished host again remarked, "Observe attentively. Might not the person intended by Sayyid Kazem be none other than I?" I thereupon felt impelled to present to him a copy of the treatise which I had with me. "Will you," I asked him, "read this book of mine and look at its pages with indulgent eyes? I pray you to overlook my weaknesses and failings." He graciously complied with my wish. He opened the book, glanced at certain passages, closed it, and began to address me. Within a few minutes he had, with characteristic vigor and charm, unraveled all its mysteries and resolved all its problems. Having to my entire satisfaction accomplished within so short a time the task I had expected him to perform, he further expounded to me certain truths which could be found neither in the reported sayings of the Imams of the Faith nor in the writings of Sheikh Ahmed and Sayyid Kazem. These truths, which I have never heard before, seem to be endowed with refreshing vividness and power.
Had you not been my guest, he afterwards observed, your position would indeed have been a grievous one. The all-encompassing grace of God has saved you. It is for God to test his servants and not for his servants to judge him in accordance with their deficient standards. Were I to fail to resolve your perplexities, could the reality that shineth within me be regarded as powerless, or my knowledge be accused as faulty? Nay, by the righteousness of God, it behooves in this day the peoples and nations of both the East and the West to hasten to this threshold and here seek to obtain the reviving grace of the merciful. Whoso hesitates will indeed be in grievous loss. Do not the people of the earth testify that the fundamental purpose of their creation is the knowledge and adoration of God? It behooves them to arise as earnestly and spontaneously as you have arisen, and to seek with determination and constancy their promised beloved. He then proceeded to say, now is the time to reveal the commentary on the Surah of Joseph. He took up his pen and, with incredible rapidity, revealed the entire Surah of Mulk, the first chapter of his commentary on the Surah of Joseph. The overpowering effect of the manner in which he wrote was heightened by the gentle intonation of his voice which accompanied his writing. Not for one moment did he interrupt the flow of the verses which streamed from his pen. Not once did he pause till the Surah of Mulk was finished. I sat enraptured by the magic of his voice and the sweeping force of his revelation. At last, I reluctantly arose from my seat and begged leave to depart. He smilingly bade me to be seated, and said, if you leave in such a state, whoever sees you will assuredly say, this poor youth has lost his mind. At that moment, the clock registered 2 hours and 11 minutes after sunset. This night, he declared, this very hour will in the days to come be celebrated as one of the greatest and most significant of all festivals. Render thanks to God for having graciously assisted you to attain your heart's desire and for having quaffed from the sealed wine of his utterance. Well is it with them that attain thereunto. At the third hour after sunset, my host ordered the dinner to be served. That same Ethiopian servant appeared again and spread before us the choicest food. That holy repast refreshed alike my body and soul. In the presence of my host at that hour, I felt as though I were feeding upon the fruits of paradise. I could not but marvel at the manners and the devoted attentions of that Ethiopian servant, whose very life seemed to have been transformed by the regenerating influence of his master. I then, for the first time, recognized the significance of this well-known traditional utterance ascribed to Muhammad. I have prepared for the godly and righteous among my servants what eye had seen not, ear heard not, nor human heart conceived. Had my youthful host no other claim to greatness, this were sufficient, that he receive me with that quality of hospitality and loving kindness which I was convinced no other human being could possibly reveal. I sat spellbound by his utterance, oblivious of time and of those who awaited me. Suddenly the call of the muazzin summoning the faithful to their morning prayer awakened me from the state of ecstasy into which I seemed to have fallen. Sleep had departed from me that night. I was enthralled by the music of that voice which rose and fell as he chanted, now swelling forth as he revealed verses of the Qayyumul Asma, again acquiring ethereal, subtle harmonies as he uttered the prayers he was revealing. He then addressed me in these words, "O thou who art the first to believe in me, verily I say, I am the Bab, the gate of God, and thou art the Babul Bab, the gate of that gate." 18 souls must in the beginning spontaneously and of their own accord accept me and recognize the truth of my revelation. And warned and uninvited, each of these must seek independently to find me. And when their number is complete, one of them must needs be chosen to accompany me on my pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina. It is incumbent upon you not to divulge either to your companions or to any other soul that which you have seen and heard. Be engaged in the Masjid-e-Ilkhani, in prayer and in teaching. I too will there join you in congregational prayer. Beware, lest your attitude towards me betray the secret of your faith. You should continue in this occupation and maintain this attitude until our departure for Hejaz, meaning Arabia. Ere we depart, we shall appoint and to each of the 18 souls his special mission, and shall send them forth to accomplish their task. We shall instruct them to teach the word of God and to quicken the souls of men. Having spoken these words to me, he dismissed me from his presence. Accompanying me to the door of the house, he committed me to the care of God. As was mentioned in the introduction, the Guardian stated that it is obligatory to celebrate the anniversary of the birth of Abdu'l-Bahá. This tribute of Baha'u'lláh in a letter he wrote in his own handwriting to Abdu'l-Bahá while the latter was on a trip to Beirut gives an indication about his rank and station in Baha'u'lláh's eyes.
Praise be to him who hath honored the land of Bah through the presence of him round whom all names revolve. All the atoms of the earth have announced unto all created things that from behind the gate of the prison city there hath appeared, and above its horizon there hath shone forth the orb of the beauty of the great, the most mighty branch. His ancient and immutable mystery, proceeding on its way to another land. Sorrow thereby hath enveloped this prison city, whilst another land rejoiceth. Blessed, doubly blessed, is the ground which his footsteps have trodden, the eye that hath been cheered by the beauty of his countenance, the ear that hath been honored by hearkening to his call, the heart that hath tasted the sweetness of his love, the breast that hath dilated through his remembrance, the pen that hath voiced his praise, the scroll that hath borne the testimony of his writings. We beseech God, blessed and exalted be he, that he may honor us with meeting him soon. He is, in truth, the all-hearing, the all-powerful, he who is ready to answer.
Abdu'l-Bahá was the eldest son of Baha'u'lláh and Awsiyyah Khanum, also called Nawwab, but not their firstborn. Two before him died in infancy. Abdu'l-Bahá, named Abbas, was born in Tehran in the 9th year of his parents' marriage. In his childhood, he suffered from the serious illness of tuberculosis. He witnessed how, after Baha'u'lláh's arrest and imprisonment in 1852, his mother went from riches to poverty, to the point that one day she could give him nothing to eat but a handful of flour. The worst trauma was seeing his father brought out with the rest of the prisoners to the courtyard of the prison. The appearance of his beloved father was so degraded from the cruelties inflicted upon him that Abdu'l-Bahá fainted. He was only 8 years old. Then, under exile, in the middle of winter to Baghdad, his feet became injured with frostbite. A pleasant note in the childhood of Abdu'l-Bahá in Tehran is the following story which staggers the mind. You remember that Tahereh spent about 4 years in Tehran, the first few months as a guest in the house of Baha'u'lláh. One day she was playing with Abdu'l-Bahá when she was informed about the arrival of Wahid, the distinguished follower of the Bab, to visit her. Wahid's prominence was acknowledged by all. To the surprise of everyone, she did not appear eager to go and speak to him. The bewilderment of the ladies in attendance increased as the delay prolonged. Then one of the ladies, feeling quite uneasy, said that it would be preferable if the distinguished Wahid were not kept awaiting any longer. Upon hearing this, Tahereh turned to Abdu'l-Bahá and said, "Shall I leave you, the protector of the cause, for visiting a follower of the cause?" What insight! Her intuition was repeatedly demonstrated throughout her dazzling but tragic life. In those days, it was customary to escape the hot months of summer in Tehran. Families of notables would leave Tehran for summer homes in the mountain. Such was the custom for Baha'u'lláh's family also. However, one summer Abdu'l-Bahá could not leave the city because his illness of tuberculosis needed medical attention in Tehran. He considered his illness a blessing, for when his beloved father was imprisoned in the Black Pit, that summer he was there to help his mother and to be included in the exile journey to Baghdad.
And thus was born on this very day in 1844 the mystery of God, whose lifespan of 77 years covered the heroic or apostolic age of the Baha'i era. It is no coincidence that Abdu'l-Bahá's birth was on the day of the declaration of the Bab, and his resting place is next to that of the Babs, under the golden dome of the shrine of the Bab on the slopes of Mount Carmel. of the Bob presentation, 12 minutes.
On that October 20, 1819, a most unique child was born. He was named Ali Muhammad. His destiny was to usher in a new cycle in religious evolution. He was born in the city of nightingales and poets, Shiraz, in southern Iran. Both of his parents were descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, signified by the prefix of Sayyid. In a tablet, Baha'u'llah glorifies the Bab in the following words:
"All praise be to thee, O my God, inasmuch as thou hast adorned the world with the splendor of the dawn, following the night wherein was born the One who heralded the manifestation of thy transcendent sovereignty. The dayspring of thy divine essence and the revelation of thy supreme lordship. I beseech thee, O Creator of the heavens and fashioner of names, to graciously aid those who have sheltered beneath the shadow of thine abounding mercy and have raised their voices amidst the peoples of the world for the glorification of thy name." Baha'u'llah closes the tablet with this utterance: "This glorious tablet hath been revealed on the anniversary of the birth of the Bab, that thou mayest recite it in a spirit of humility and supplication, and give thanks unto thy Lord, the all-knowing, the all-informed. Make thou every effort to render service unto God, that from thee may appear that which will immortalize thy memory in his glorious and exalted heaven. Say, glorified art thou, O my God. I implore thee by the dawning place of thy signs, and by the revealer of thy clear tokens, to grant that I may, under all conditions, hold fast the cord of thy loving providence, and cling tenaciously to the hem of thy generosity. Reckon me then with those whom the changes and chances of the world have failed to deter from serving thee and from bearing allegiance unto thee, whom the onslaught of the people hath been powerless to hinder from magnifying thy name and celebrating thy praise. Graciously assist me, O my Lord, to do whatever thou lovest and desirest. Enable me then to fulfill that which will exalt thy name and will set ablaze the fire of thy love. Thou art in truth the forgiving, the bountiful."
The Bab was less than 9 years old when his father passed away and was raised by his maternal uncle, Haji Mirza Sayyid Ali, who later believed in him and was martyred. That blessed uncle placed the Bab under the care of a tutor by the name of Sheikh Abid. The Bab was not inclined to study but submitted to his uncle's will. Sheikh Abid, a man of piety and learning, had been a disciple of the two luminaries Sheikh Ahmad and Sayyid Kazim. The memoirs of Sheikh Abid about his most illustrious and unusual student are in the hands of his descendants, who have not made it available to the Baha'is. You like to know that later on the Sheikh became a follower of the Bab. Of a few stories available from that period of the Bab's life, one will be shared with you. Sheikh Abid states that one day he asked the Bab to recite the opening words of the Quran, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, meaning in the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. The Bab hesitated and said unless he was told the significance of those words, he would not recite them. The Sheikh pretended he did not know. Then the Bab stated, "I know, and if you permit me, I will explain it." The Sheikh states, "He spoke with such knowledge and fluency that I was struck with amazement, and in terms such as I had neither read or heard. The sweetness of his utterance still rings in my memory. I felt impelled to take him back to his uncle and deliver into his hands the trust he had committed to my care. I determined to tell him how unworthy I felt to teach so remarkable a child. I found his uncle alone in his office and said, "I have brought him back to you and commit him to your vigilant protection." The uncle sternly rebuked the Bob and told him, "Have you forgotten my instructions? Have I not already admonished you to follow the example of your fellow pupils, to observe silence, and listen attentively to every word spoken by your teacher?" Then the uncle told the Bob to return to school. Altogether, he had 6 or 7 years of schooling, and after repeated evidences of his superhuman wisdom and innate knowledge, the uncle accepted to let the young Bob leave the school. The following are the stories of the Bob's early years. It is related by Haji Sayyid Javad Karbalawi, a veteran and distinguished believer in both the Bab and later in Baha'u'llah. He resided in Karbala but was a man of travel. One of his journeys took him to Shiraz when the Bab was about 9 years old. While visiting the Bab's eldest uncle, he states, "On one occasion he heard the melodious and enchanting voice of a young person chanting. Then the Bab came out of a room and the uncle introduced him as his nephew, who was orphaned." In another occasion, Haji's visit was at the time when the Bab returned from school holding a batch of papers. Upon questioning, he told Haji that they were his penmanship exercise. When Haji looked at his penmanship, he could not help but to marvel at its excellence. Sometimes later, Haji saw the Bab in the port city of Bushehr, working in association with his eldest uncle. The final visit was when the Bab, in his early 20s, went to Karbala. It is gratifying to know that a man blessed to watch the Bab as a child, youth, and adult came to recognize the station of that holy youth. Here is the fascinating story of how he accepted the Bab. The Bab instructed all the letters of the living to disperse and spread the glad tidings of his appearance. However, they were forbidden to mention his name and identity. When Mullah Ali Bastami arrived in Karbala with the breathtaking news of the advent of the Bab, it rapidly spread far and wide. Of course, Haji Javad, a devout disciple of Sayyid Kazim, took it seriously, but was totally mystified as to who might be the person declaring such a claim. He invited Mullah Ali to his house and tried various approaches to find the identity of the one claiming to be the Bab. He was told over and over by Mullah Ali that it was forbidden to mention his name. Badly frustrated, he resorted to force. By his own admission, Haji Javad grabbed the arms of Mullah Ali, pushed him against the wall, and exclaimed, "What am I to do with you? Kill you?" Gasping for breath, Mullah Ali said, "You are a learned man and know well what the word forbidden means." Then, without any forethought, Mullah Ali said that the Bab had instructed him to gather all of the letters which the Bab had written to people in Karbala and sent them to him. Haji Javad states, as soon as Mullah Ali mentioned the letters, he had in a flash a mental picture of Sayyid Ali Muhammad, meaning the Bab. Haji let go of Mullah Ali and went to get the letters he had from Sayyid Ali Muhammad. When Mullah Ali saw the Bab's seal on them, he burst into tears, and so did his host Haji Javad. They wept for joy, and between his sobs, Mullah Ali kept repeating, "I did not mention any name to you. It is forbidden." The Bab, after schooling with Sheikh Obed, in all probability left the school before he was 13. He joined his two uncles in business as a merchant when he was 15 years old. Then, shortly afterward, at age 16, he moved to the seaport city of Bushehr in association with his eldest uncle. Because of his skill and uncompromised honesty, he soon took over the complete management of the trading house there. When about 22 years old, he went for pilgrimage to Karbala. Upon his return, at the age of 23, he married Khadija Begum. From that union, a son named Ahmad was born, who died soon after birth in 1843. We close with these words in praise of the Bab from one of the prayers revealed by Baha'u'llah.
Magnify thou, O Lord my God, him who is the primal point, the divine mystery, the unseen essence, the dayspring of divinity, and the manifestation of thy lordship, through whom all the knowledge of the past and all the knowledge of the future were made plain, through whom the pearls of thy hidden wisdom were uncovered, and the mystery of thy treasured name disclosed, whom thou hast appointed as the announcer of the One, through whose name the letter B and the letter E have been joined and united, through whom thy majesty, thy sovereignty, and thy might were made known, through whom thy words have been sent down, and thy laws set forth with clearness, and thy signs spread abroad, and thy word established, through whom the hearts of thy chosen ones were laid bare, and all that were in the heavens and all that were on the earth were gathered together, whom thou hast called Ali Muhammad in the kingdom of thy names, and the spirit of spirits in the tablets of thine irrevocable decree, whom thou hast invested with thine own title, unto whose name all other names have at thy bidding and through the power of thy might been made to return, and in whom thou hast caused all thine attributes and titles to attain their final consummation. To him also belong such names as lay hid within thy stainless tabernacles, in thine invisible world, and thy sanctified cities.